Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Stephen, Feliz Navidad, my friend.
Merry Christmas to you too, Phil. Hope you're all ready to go.
You all set for the big day?
Well, you know, it's sort of funny. I've had my shopping done for a while, but for whatever reason, we're just kind of getting around to getting the tree up and getting the decorations all out.
Yeah,
I mean, it's sort of we're just doing things in a kind of different order this year. You know, we just for whatever reason, we were pretty busy up until this weekend, and we just started getting some stuff out this weekend. And we got the tree up, and, you know, we're officially decorated, I would say 95% as of this evening. But I don't know, we just put it off for some whatever reason. You know, in the past we've done it right after Thanksgiving and, you know, whatever. But this just, you know, we just kind of got around to it late this year.
Let me just say that I think it's fine. You know what? People used to decorate their trees on Christmas Eve, right? So,
yeah.
You know, it's totally cool to do it several days before. You know, it's kind of refreshing actually to hear people are still making those kinds of preparations. I mean, I was putting all my lights up like the Saturday after Thanksgiving, right? And purely out of peer pressure because my whole neighborhood does that whole thing. So, you know, I think you guys are doing fine. You know, and leave them up for a while. That's my advice. Leave them up till, you know, maybe, well, not Super Bowl, but say. You know, January 10th, something like that, right?
When's Epiphany fall? Some denominations in the Catholic Church recognize
January 6th. And that way you'll have it up for all 12 days of Christmas, you see. So you'll actually you celebrate the whole Christmas season. That's good. not only will you be like the last person in your neighborhood with your decorations up, which will be fun, but you'll be educating your neighbors, right?
Exactly. I can, you know, say, hey, you know, it's not officially over. The wise men show up, guys. You know,
yeah, exactly. The party ain't over. So we do the gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Okay.
That's exactly it. Get some culture. You know, read a book. Yeah.
Well, you know, politely. I mean, you want to do it politely, but
yeah.
Okay. Well, we've got a terrific lineup of topics tonight. Kind of a mixed bag, but a little bit of a theme running through it, because we're talking about several things that have to do with MIT, and the first one, our actual lead-off topic this evening, the title of the show is Higher Ed X, and I'm taking that from the name of this new program that MIT is offering, MIT X. Where does this little underscore, this little lowercase x come from? Because I noticed that when TED spins off conferences elsewhere that aren't the actual TED conference, that's TED X. And now MIT is doing this thing where it's kind of quasi-MIT, it's sort of almost MIT, and they're calling it MITx. Do you have any idea what the origin of that is, where that comes from?
I have no idea. I think TED might be the first to have done it. I noticed one person that was tweeting about it said, love it that MIT is, you know, nodding to TED on this little deal, you know, with their little MITx going on there. But yeah, maybe we should research that and find out if there's if the X you know, means something in Greek, or who knows? You know, what's going on with the little X after?
Yeah, what's up with the X? Anybody in the chat room? Yeah. Is there a mathematical notation that makes that make sense? Whatever it is, we're intrigued, but I don't know what to make of it. But I think it's cool. I immediately saw it and made the connection with TEDx and thought that's very cool. But for those who aren't familiar with what we're talking about, this is really interesting. We have been talking for, years now about the fundamental changes that are taking place in the education infrastructure in our country. And recently, last couple of years, there's been a lot of talk about this education bubble, especially the higher education bubble. And it's very interesting to see how things are changing. You know, we have a situation where at one time, institutions of higher learning had the monopoly on knowledge. They were the centers of knowledge. And that day is now well past, right? We have multiple sources of information. And I pointed out in the blog post I wrote about this that day really started ending with the wide availability of public libraries. Once you had a public library, anybody could go get the same information that most scholars could avail themselves of. But that's not the same. As Brent Iverson pointed out over on Transparency Revolution, we were talking about this a few weeks ago, information is not exactly the same thing as instruction. It's not the same thing as education. And so even though they no longer had the monopoly on information, they did have the monopoly on education until, I think it was about 5 years ago and that we announced this, that MIT opened up. They were the first big major university to do this, opened up their course catalog and said, we're going to provide our courseware online for free. That people who want to can get a good MIT education. They can take our classes and benefit from the tremendous educational resources that this institution provides. That was a huge
worldwide. Yeah, you know, and the idea is, you know, how many geniuses in the world are there, Phil, that wouldn't have a chance to go to MIT? You know, and the idea is, by offering this to the world, perhaps there's, some potential Einstein or, who knows what, out there that could benefit from this, and then the world would in turn benefit from that person having received a world-class education, even though they didn't have the money, the resources, or whatever kept them from being able to get to a university like MIT. And so, yeah, it's a
absolutely
fantastic idea, but there's still, you could attend all those courses virtually. You could learn all that information, but then there'd still be doors closed to you, and you wouldn't have an MIT diploma.
The deal was, you still don't have a degree, and a lot of other schools started following suit. Now, almost all major institutions of higher learning have some level of free courseware that they're providing, all following the example that the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, we should give their full name here at some point in the show, the trend that they set. And then some upstarts came along too, some completely new approaches. And we've talked about Khan Academy, and there are quite a few others, folks who are providing college level instruction completely outside of the context of a university. So there's more and more ways for people to get education than ever before in the past. But the clincher has been, the kicker has been, to your point, Stephen, that you still can't get a degree. And this was, I think, kind of the saving grace of the program as it was probably first introduced. I mean, this is probably how they got it passed in the first place.
Right.
They were able to say to the Board of Regents, it's okay, it doesn't count, they still won't get an MIT degree. And as I was writing about on the blog, it shows that what these universities are truly selling, what their product really is a credential, that they're in the business of providing credentials and that they're in the business of giving you this network of contacts that you wouldn't have had you not gone to MIT. I mean, those are really the two big benefits of going to Yale or Stanford or MIT or one of these big schools. I mean, this is the reason people do it. And a few years ago, when they first introduced this program, it seemed that the likely case would be that you'd never be able to get an MIT degree from taking their free courseware. But now here comes MITx, and it's a bit of a game changer, isn't it?
It could be. Now, explain to me, Phil. I mean, because you actually wrote this up for the Speculists. You blogged about it already. Tell me, to what extent does what kind of credentialing are they offering those who never set foot on the campus, never attend a live lecture, but do get all this coursework online? What sort of credentialing are we talking about with MITx?
It's a little vague. Let me read to you from the press release that MIT put up about this. They said MIT today announced the launch of an online learning initiative internally called MITx. Well, they got to keep that name because it's cool. MITx will offer a portfolio of MIT courses through an online interactive learning platform that will organize and present course material to enable students to learn at their own pace, feature interactivity, online laboratories, and student-to-student communication, allow for individual assessment of any student's work, and allow students who demonstrate their mastery of subjects to earn a certificate of completion awarded by MITx. Operate open-source scalable software infrastructure in order to make it continuously improving and readily available to other educational institutions. So it's not a degree from MIT.
No.
But it is certification that you have achieved. You know, it's like the GED of MIT is the closest,
yeah.
Right? Is the closest analogy I can make. It seems to be. Now, reading
let's think about it. Let's think about it, Phil. Let's say you're an employer for a major corporation that needs engineers that have a certain level of experience. Here, if somebody showed up, with a degree from the local state school, he's got an engineering degree from the local state school, and he's had a couple of jobs that he's done well in, but he also had, on his resume, MITx, where he basically buffed up different areas of study that he was interested in and kept his education ongoing. Wouldn't that impress you? I mean, that's to me that it's not like an engineering degree or anything, but it would impress me as a potential employer that here we have an engineer who does have a degree from secondary school, nothing like MIT, but then he turns around and continues to work. He or she continues to work in his field of study. And doing that would just impress me as a potential employer. And
I think it would be too.
Yeah.
Let's make it a little trickier. Let's say that you've got two candidates. One has, like you said, they've got the University of Kansas State University degree, and they did well in school. And the other one only has a high school diploma, but has the MITx certification, and all other things are equal, right?
Yeah.
They both have equal experience, and they, by and large, look like equal candidates. Well, you look at the one who has the certification from MIT, assuming that is to the level of a degree, and I'm not sure that's the case because it just says mastery of a subject, and we're not sure what that means. I mean, it's like I said, it's all a little vague right now. But assuming that means at the level of a bachelor's degree. So you've got two people, and they both have a credential of a bachelor's degree, one from Kansas, one from sort of MIT, right? It's the MIT MIT GED. So to me there's a bit of prestige associated with that, and you're an employer who doesn't normally get the regular MIT candidates, so it's not like one of them is going to be showing up and being competing for that job anyway. The other factor that you're going to take into consideration is, this person really had to be a go-getter. This person really had to be a self-paced learner, a disciplined person, someone who was willing to take, carve out the time and make this thing happen. Because that's that's the big difference between getting a certification like this and getting a standard degree, is that you're in charge. It will happen if you make it happen. Now, that's going to be true going to college too. But there's a lot more structure in place when you go to a standard university than when you go to than when you set out to achieve a certification like this. And I think that might be a big factor too.
Can I answer your question? I think that let's say that I'm the potential employer looking at those
okay.
two. I would be excited about the MITx candidate, but here's why. I would think, all right, here I got a motivated self-starter that really has mastery of this material and everything, but I can get them cheaper than the guy that went and actually got the degree. You know, the guy that went and actually got the degree, he's sitting on student loans. He's got a certain expectation about, you know, what he has to have to get, you know, to. And whereas this guy has mastery of the same materials. He's got a world-class education. He does not have student loans. And I think I can get him cheaper. And I'm excited about the MIT guy. The MITx guy, I should say. And so that's I think that that's one way employers will start to look at it. They can say, hey, you know, the knowledge is and the education is available, and we know that they actually got it because the certification is it's not easily I'm sure they'll figure out ways to keep it from being counterfeited easily, you know.
Right.
And so, once employers can depend on it, you know, these people actually do have the knowledge that the certification says that they do, they're going to be excited about these candidates because they don't have the student debt. You know, I mean, it's crushing debt. Some of these people are, you know, spend a lifetime paying it off. You know, they're just getting their own student debt out of the way when their own kids go off to college. That's how, you know,
absolutely.
That's what we're talking
about. Yeah.
You know, that's what we're talking about. So.
People well into their 40s still paying off their, or maybe older. I don't know. There are probably sad stories yet to come about that, and it's that's why they call it a bubble. I mean, there's something fundamentally wrong with the whole setup. Your college education shouldn't be something that is a financial burden for the rest of your life. It's supposed to be a financial benefit, right? That's that's the whole problem. But I think you make a really good point. And what I see potentially happening here, we shall see. There's a lot to yet happen. But to me, I look at this and I see the seeds of the solution to the higher education bubble. And the solution is that the institutions of higher learning that we have remain in place, and those that offer superior credentials will continue to have a large student body. There will still be people who will be able to afford to go to those and who will go through those programs. But anyone who wants to get a degree or anyone who wants to get as good a credential, it'll be available to them. So this like world-class education becomes available to anyone who wants it. And you know, we talk about it in the U.S. We talk about it for people who want to avoid this whole student loan crunch, and that's wonderful in its own right. I mean, that's great if people can avoid the student loans and if the kinds of education that people need become available to them. But going back to what you were talking about earlier, this just makes it all the more worthwhile for people in the developing world. You know, anyone with an internet connection, anyone who is able to access this information. I mean, it's hard to say what the impact of that will be. I think it's going to be profound. Your point about an Einstein from India or you know an Einstein from Africa, I think is very well taken. I think that we will be seeing people of that caliber, people of that level, who will have come up on their own, motivated just by their desire to improve their lives, just by their desire to learn, who will have taken advantage of these kinds of programs and end up changing the world in really profound ways. I think it's an extremely exciting development, and it's a great way to end the year, actually, with a story like this, isn't it?
It's awesome. I've heard statistics like, China has as many geniuses as we have people, you know, and it's just a matter of statistics. You know, they have so many people that if only a certain percentage of their population is genius, just like the same percentage of our population, they still have more geniuses than we have people. It's that's how many people they have. But, you know, most of those geniuses are trapped on farms that, you know, subsistence agriculture is how they're getting by. Now, you know, I'm sure their farm is pretty – it had some innovations, you know, that are pretty awesome because they're geniuses. But,
right, they've come up with some clever ways of doing things, for sure, yeah.
For sure, but, they're probably, as far as the world is concerned, there's probably better uses for them. And, you know, if they can get their hands on a world-class education like this, you know, we all benefit. And so, yes, it's an exciting development. And, you know, I look forward to seeing where this goes. And, you know, unfortunately, it may be a few years before we kind of know how this is going to be, you know, how this is, what direction this is going. But it's an exciting beginning.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're just now at the stage where the people who first started taking advantage of free courseware from MIT and from some, or from Khan Academy or from any of these places, these people are probably just now sort of arriving into professional life, or maybe won't be even for a couple or three more years. So so it's all going to unfold over the next decade or so. But I think we're going to see some major stuff coming our way. Okay, so cool. What's our next topic this evening, Stephen? I remember we talked about several things, but we'll back and forth. And actually, I think you had a kind of an interesting thing that was developed at MIT.
Absolutely. This is not just kind of interesting. This could be profound.
Talk about a game changer. Holy cow.
Yeah. Is a cure for the common cold on the way? That's the title of this article. But it's bigger than that, Phil. An MIT researcher, and let's see, what is this guy's name? Todd Ryder at MIT has developed an antiviral drug called Draco. He's calling it Draco, which means dragon in Latin, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah, interesting. Yes.
Yeah, his drug is called Draco, which has proven successful against all 15 viruses to which it has been applied in lab trials with human tissue and in mice. The viruses include the common cold, H1N1, swine flu, poliovirus, dengue fever, and Ebola. And what he did was he took an unusual approach in doing this. He wired together two natural proteins. One that detects the virus entry into a cell, and another that acts as a suicide switch that kills the infected cell before it can become a viral factory. That's what happens. See, a virus goes into a cell, and it takes over the cell, instructing the cell to produce more viruses to release, you know, throughout the body. And this particular drug says, "Hey, you're infected. Kill yourself." Boom, the cell stops and it dies rather than, you know, becoming something that, you know, it can infect the rest of the body. So, and this particular approach is, you know, it's a broad based approach that has worked against all the viruses that it's been tested with, and that's just amazing. So, anyway,
is there something about it that is keyed to particular viruses, or will it theoretically work on any virus?
Well, that's according to the story I'm reading here, and you know, Phil, this is, you know, it's short on detail. This is, you know, very much a public news kind of story. It's not a journal article, but it would appear based on this what I'm reading here that it's broad based. It's any virus, and so if it, you know, you can imagine. You talk about a game changer, Phil.
Let's think about the implications here. So, let's say you got a cold. So your doctor gives you this to cure your cold. And then after that, you'll never get any virus again. Am I hearing it correctly? Is that right?
I don't know if it stays in your body forever, or if Draco just fights the viruses that are currently in your body, and then, you know, and it's out of your system, and then you can catch a virus later, and you have to get another dose of Draco. I don't know how that works, but it's pretty exciting, though.
I'm interested. You know, I mean,
that's right. Anytime I'm feeling a little low, maybe I should go and get a little booster of Draco. Maybe it works like that. I don't know. But it's just fascinating. I'm gonna be following. You know, I'm gonna get a little alert set up to where whenever another story about this comes out, I'm informed, because this is potentially a big deal. So.
Well. The fact that they mention dengue fever, we've talked about that before. That is a killer. That is a terrible, dreaded disease in much of the developing world. When I lived in Malaysia, this was something that there was always great fear when there were outbreaks of that, because, you know, once you got it, forget it. You know, I mean, it, game over.
Yeah.
So
that's right.
So the idea that there might be something. I mean, if it was just a cure for that, it would be great. Right, you know.
Right. Yeah.
This sounds like something potentially much bigger than that. I mean, there are a lot of forms of cancer that are triggered by virus, right? Viruses are a host of ills.
Think about something like rabies that is not very common, but you know, so people are not going to. I think rabies is viral, isn't it? I believe that it is.
I think so. Yeah.
You know, it's viruses like that that are not very common, but I mean, if somebody gets it. I mean, they're done for, you know. So nobody's going to spend, but since it's like, I think they had like one case in the last 50 years in the United States. I mean, it's just, you know, it's crazy rare to get something terrible like that. But, and so no one's going to spend the money it takes to come out with a drug to cure rabies, you know, unfortunately. And because
right.
It's just so rare. But what if we had a broad-based drug that could attack all viruses? You know, you get something, you know, exotic like that, and we still can help you. We've got this thing that hits all viruses, and so that's just a really, really cool potential development. I'm going to be watching that one.
Yeah, let's watch that one. I think we'll see some. Hopefully, we'll see some validation of this in the coming years. And who knows? Maybe down the road we'll look back on the days when people used to worry about viruses. Wouldn't that be nice?
Sally asks, does it work with retroviruses? Again, I don't know. The story is a little short on detail, but I did put the link up just then, and so you can check it out yourself. And I'm going to be watching for more news on this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of things to be worried about, now I put a post up on it's actually on both my blogs now, both on the Speculist and over at Transparency Revolution. But I put it up there first, called "Backing Up Civilization," and this I was inspired to write this. There was a story earlier this week, a really sad story about a library in Egypt that was destroyed during some recent protests. I don't know if you heard about this, but. It's quite sad. There were manuscripts, there were documents in there, not ancient, but dating back a couple hundred years. There were things that were written at the time of Napoleon's conquest of Egypt and that sort of thing. So some, you know, priceless, interesting historical documents. And the fact that it occurred in Egypt reminded me of the destruction of the Library of Alexandria, which,
yeah.
for those who aren't familiar with that, that was... I described it as the Library of Congress of the ancient world. This was a very interesting thing they had going in Alexandria back in ancient times, was that any ship that came into port, it was required that if there were any books on board that ship, that they be brought to the library and the scribes of the library be allowed to copy it. And over the years, they put together the greatest collection of books in the world. Virtually all the books that existed in the world at the time, or at least that existed and that came into contact with Alexandria, ended up in that library. And we know from references in other ancient texts of books that existed that were almost certainly in that library, and it was destroyed. So a lot of really interesting stuff from the past was lost. Maybe some really
right.
critical stuff, maybe things that would have been tremendously helpful trying to get out of the Dark Ages and stuff like that, were lost when this library was burned down. One of the things that's really interesting to me about this is it's uncertain when it happened, that there's stories about Julius Caesar burning it down, that there's multiple stories all the way up from like 4800 BC all the way up to 642 AD. Now, I got in trouble on the blog with some people for saying BCE and CE, which is what I normally do when I write. And then when I talk out loud, I usually say the other thing. So I also wish people a Merry Christmas, by the way. Especially, you know what? Especially those people who gave me a hard time about the BCE thing. I hope they have a wonderful Christmas. The thing is, there's like this just interesting, like this almost 700-year period of time during which it might have happened, which indicates that probably several events happened. And that the
yeah.
thing was slowly but surely stamped out. And it's a huge loss. I know that there was much knowledge in the ancient world. There's probably much knowledge that was even in the medieval world that we don't have anymore. And the reason we don't have it is because before printing, all reproduction required some poor monk, you know, someplace sitting down with a quill pen and painstakingly writing a document out. Well, once there was printing, a lot more redundancy got built into the system, and a lot more knowledge was preserved. But there's
the mystery of what we lost, Phil. Think of a movie like National Treasure. You know, when they open up the treasure vault, and they see, you know, you see just practically, you know, as far as the eye can see in that cave is gold and everything. And of course, one of the first things they come across is scrolls from the Library of Alexandria. You know, I mean,
right, exactly.
The idea that the world's greatest treasure would have information like that we could reclaim, and that would be awesome. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I imagine that much of what was lost, at least, you know, as far as knowledge about, you know, mathematics and things like that, has been recreated over the years. But history, you know, world history cannot be reclaimed that same way, can it? So
that's right.
You know, it's sad in a way that's just ongoing. you don't ever get
get it back. I mean, that's the thing. Absent time travel or something, there's just no getting it back. And that was the point I made in the blog post, was that if you lose an old book, that's sad. I mean, it's a terrible loss. If you lose an old book, especially an interesting one, like there was this thing, it was just called The Description of Egypt. I mean, it was, you know, in French was the actual title, but that's what it boils down to. And it was written by hundreds of different members of the bureaucracy, the French bureaucracy, who were there in Egypt over that period of time. It's like this 24-volume book, priceless collection of observations about Egypt made, you know, written in the hand of the people who were observing it back at that time. It's a tragedy. It looks like that book was lost. But there's a saving grace, which was that there's another copy someplace, right? So, okay,
right.
The book was lost. This handwritten book, this priceless artifact is lost, but at least we still have the information. And I think that's your point too, right? It's like if you lose an old book, that's sad. If you lose the information that was an old book, that's tragic. That's terrible. And my point in the article is that there's, you know, we live in a day and age when there's no excuse to lose any information anymore. And I think that if there are rare artifacts, rare books, that those need to be backed up. And I talked about digital backup. I got a lot of criticism around going digital from different people taking different angles. And people make some really good points. People talk about the fact that there were digital records about the Apollo program that were put in formats that were no longer supported, and then the media disintegrated, and we actually lost records around the Apollo program because it was digitized. CDs don't last forever, magnetic drives don't last forever. There's nothing that lasts forever, and the formats change so rapidly that if you digitize something today, there's not even a guarantee you'll be able to access that information 10 years from now. This is all true.
I take a little bit of an issue with that, because I think things have settled down just a little bit in that regard. Because, I mean, think about it. 20 years ago, there were disks and various, you know, things that you'd plug into your computer to get the information off of it. You know, we still have CDs as a potential mechanism for putting information in your computer, but that's not the primary thing anymore, is it? It's just straight access with the internet now, and so if it's on the internet and it's backed up in multiple locations on the internet, it's could be pretty much with us permanently, you know.
That's the point. Once you're in the cloud, as long as the cloud is self-sustaining, whatever the disks underlying the cloud are, and they can keep changing, as long as that overall massive information is still being supported by this evolving infrastructure, then you're okay. I think the cloud is really the answer, and I think that those objections fall down exactly for that reason.
Yeah.
There was another set of arguments that had to do with, well, EMPs. You know, what if we lose electricity? What if these folks are really talking about saving civilization. And that's a good point. I mean, if things are going to go that far, if we're going to have a huge solar flare, or if there's going to be weapons of mass destruction that are used to give a give an electromagnetic burst, then we need to have ways of storing and then retrieving ultimately all the information that goes on the internet that we don't currently have. We need to have ways of storing that stuff that we'll be able to get to, no matter what.
You know, the smart aleck response to these folks would be, well, if you feel strongly about it, I suggest you print out the internet. Get started. It's going to take you a while.
I don't know if you read the comments, but I mean, it sounded like that's what some people were suggesting. Well, actually, one guy said, let's put it all on clay tablets and bury it in the desert, which I thought was fantastic.
I don't think that there's enough desert to bury it, you know, bury it in it.
I don't think there is either. But it's interesting because it becomes this whole other discussion. And it's an important one, which is kind of the resiliency of all the information we have now. All I was really talking about was like rare collections of books that
right.
that those should be photographed and digitized and put up in the cloud so that we don't lose them, so that we hang on, or not just rare collections of books, but maps and any of those kinds of documents, things that could potentially burn or get destroyed in a flood or you know, some other catastrophe could hit them. But once you start talking about this, you start thinking about, well, you know, what if you lost that, right? What if the infrastructure that was in place to keep that going proved invalid? Well, it's a good series of questions to continually ask. But I think you and I are on the same page that
yep.
the long run answer is going to be digital. And if our digital solutions aren't good enough now, we need to make those better, because I really don't think paper will be a long term solution.
It's just not. There's not enough paper in the world for the information that is being produced on a yearly basis. We're doubling our information on a yearly basis. There simply aren't enough trees. I mean, it comes
right.
down to that. So we need to harden up our infrastructure, perhaps, in response to their criticism. Yeah, sure. Let's figure out ways that, you know, if we have a major solar flare, that we don't go down. I think that's a fantastic idea. But we're just getting past the point where we can have everything on paper. It's just, you know, if we're not there yet, we're going to be there very, very, very soon. So we might as well begin preparing and harden up our infrastructure, get ready. But anyway, your comment about the Apollo program reminded me of something I read about a year or so back. It was not only have we lost information on the Apollo program because of the media problems and things like that, but there's also this fact I heard that the engineers were so rushed to get us to the moon that they didn't document like they normally would. And so, you know, basically when those engineers, you know, finished the job and then slowly began to forget those things and, you know, begin to die off and things like that, I mean, at the time that we decided to go back to the moon, much of it will have to be much of that what they did will have to be relearned.
Wow!
And I have no doubt that we can do it. It just would take a major effort, a much more major effort than if we had done a better job documenting what they were doing at the time and then saving it better once we had it. So, anyway, that's an interesting case study in the loss of information in a relatively modern period, right? So.
Well, absolutely. Right. My master's degree is in technical communication. I was a technical writer for years. And, Stephen, what you just said is what I've been trying to tell people for a long time, okay? It's like, if you don't document things, this is what happens.
It just goes away.
It does. I mean, you're one or two people leaving or people being fired or people dying away from not being able to continue a process frequently. I mean, a lot of organizations – a few years ago, especially, it really existed that way. And I had not heard that about Apollo, but that's a fascinating, huge example of a principle I've seen in businesses throughout my entire career, which is that the knowledge exists, but it's not properly documented. It exists partly documented and partly in the minds of smart people who are able to just keep executing, and they keep executing, and then they're not there anymore, and the partial documentation doesn't cut it anymore. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a tremendous example. I hope that anyone who's listening who teaches technical writing, make sure your students have been impressed with this story, because that's a good one to pass on. Okay. So what's our next topic, Stephen?
Hey, let's segue to traveling to the moon. How about that?
There you go.
This is an interesting story. This is done by a blogger. This is not like a major news organization here. But they go through and talk about, you know, let's say you're Peter Thiel or, you're Bill Gates, and you really want to get away from it all for a little bit. Hawaii is not quite far enough. You want to really get away from it all. What do you do? Well, you can become a space tourist, and then, this has been going on. How long has it been since maybe the first one? What about 10, 15 years ago, something like that? First person to orbit the Earth as a private citizen.
I think it's something like that. I don't know that we even done that yet. Actually, orbit.
People have we've had visitors to the Mir space station.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking by means other than the traditional stuff. You're right. Yeah. About 10 years.
Yeah. That's and these guys are getting rides on Russian rockets and things like that. The latest thing that's being offered is an orbit around the moon. Okay. And you want to hazard a guess as to what it would cost to take a ride to the moon, orbit it, and then shoot back home.
Give me a price point. What does it cost to get me to low Earth orbit, to get to the Mir space station? What am I shelling out for that?
All right, let's see here. Come on. Where's the let's see. 1 week tour to the International Space Station would cost you $35 million.
$35 million? So I'm gonna say that a trip around the moon as a consumer is going to cost me $500 million?
No, not quite that expensive.
Oh, good. Okay, good.
Oh, yeah. You can get there, and you can do this, Phil, for the bargain price of $150 million U.S. dollars.
Well, not bad at all. So only five
not
times
bad at
as much
all.
As
so
a trip
if you,
to the
if
space
if you got
station.
That laying around the house, Phil, I mean, if you got that kind of...
Let me check the couch cushions for change, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you might be going. Here's the deal. It's according to this particular blogger, a person has already booked this. This is something that someone's taken him up on that offer. So it would be a 3-person trip, and at least one of those people will have to be a cosmonaut. To run
and the other two are each paying $100.
The other two could be potential. They'll sell a seat to maybe one person, and then have two cosmonauts, or maybe two people and have one cosmonaut, and that's the deal that's being offered. And I'm just put the link here in the chat room. Yeah, Sally says $150 million. That's a lot cheaper than Apollo. Well,
good
point, Sally. That is a good point. Of course, Apollo was setting down on the moon, at least for most of its
From 11 on.
From 11 on, they were setting down.
But say 8 and 9, they cost that much. And 8, that was the one where they orbited them. I mean, this is essentially you're getting to do Apollo 8, right? You're flying to the moon, you're flying around the moon. Wow.
Hopefully not 13. You know, that would be a little bit more.
Or 13, but you are doing 13. You're doing the same trip, but maybe without.
Yeah, but it's hopefully without the same drama. You know, that's the deal. I think that's great. And I love it that the Russians are thinking of at least going and orbiting the moon again. When was the last time they did that?
You know what? I'm a big fan of the Russian space program, and my brain is not coming up with when they ever did that.
They've orbited the moon, I'm pretty sure. I think it's been done.
But it wasn't during the Apollo era, right? It was later that they did that.
It was later, and basically once they got to, they did that, they realized the cost, of going forward, and it would always look like, well, we got their second anyway, and so they just decided to not land on the moon. So.
Right,
anyway.
Because their actual manned program to the moon ended in a horrible disaster, a horrible tragedy. This big rocket they were building blew up, and like 100 people were killed on the ground. And which is why when we landed Apollo 11, they were just trying to get an unmanned probe onto the moon, just to steal a little bit of our thunder if they if they possibly could. I remember that much, but they kept at it, and they finally got to the point where they were orbiting the moon. Never put anybody down there. But once they got the process down, and that's the process that they're still replicating. I suppose they're still using those big Soyuz rockets, right? They're still using their
Saturn
V.
Yeah, and quite frankly, I think that we gave up on the Saturn V, which was a proven technology, too easily. I think we should have probably kept some Saturn V's on hand. But hey, I guess that's what SpaceX is kind of doing. They're kind of rebuilding Saturn V level launchers, and not quite yet, but they're getting to the point they can put big stuff in orbit with half sized Saturn V's and things like that. So they eventually want to produce very soon something on par with Saturn V and even greater, to perhaps put something, put major payload headed to Mars, things like that. So,
wow. Very well, there it is. And you've just reminded me, SpaceX, there's another thing with the X.
We've got to figure out what the X thing is about. With TEDx and with MITx, it means you get the good stuff without actually being there. Maybe, so sort of a little X might mean something like virtual,
Alternative or something like that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, maybe it means alternative, because SpaceX would certainly fall into that, wouldn't it? So
right. Interesting. What's this X thing all about? Well,
we got to figure that out.
Slowly unraveling the mystery as we go here tonight. Well, I've got another story tied back into MIT lightly. Which I tweeted this earlier today. This is an interesting story over in Technology Review, which of course is a publication of MIT, and the headline was "Tectonic Shifts in Employment," and the subhead was "Information Technology is Reducing the Need for Certain Jobs Faster than New Ones Are Being Created." Now, this is interesting for us not because it's big news. We've talked about this possibility repeatedly over the last couple of years, and this is the basis of Martin Ford's book, The Lights in the Tunnel. But I thought it was really interesting to see a write-up of this in MIT in Technology Review, taken kind of from the standpoint of the technology rather than strictly as an economics discussion. They have this the story is accompanied by this big picture showing these Luddites. It's one of these old like tin type pictures, and they've got their hammers and they're smashing the machine. And this is the argument that you often run into when you start talking about this phenomenon. The point is that it looks like we may have reached an inflection point. We may have reached a point where accelerating technological development is outpacing the ability of the economy to produce new jobs. And so the machines are taking over faster than we're going to be able to keep up with, and we're seeing, as a result of that, we're seeing a net decrease in the actual number of jobs. And this thing starts out, it says, the United States faces a protracted unemployment crisis. 6.3 million fewer Americans have jobs than was true at the end of 2007, and yet the country's economic output is higher today than it was before the financial crisis. That's the bottom line. Production is going up. The number of people required to produce what we're producing is going down. There's a lot of things in play there. They talk about outsourcing in addition to technology. And I think there's also just a kind of a increased efficiency within corporate processes and people doubling up jobs and stuff like that. That all plays a role, especially in a tight economy. But the one that won't go away when the economy improves is the driver of automation, of technological development actually replacing human labor. So this is one we've puzzled around before. What do we make of this? Does this mean that the economy has to change completely? Do we eliminate the idea of work? Are we gonna be divided into some kind of weird science fiction world where 20% of the people work and 80% of the people don't, or something like that, and we just don't know. I mean, there are a lot of different possibilities opening up in front of us around how this might play out. But as I read those statistics around we're producing more than we were in 2007, but we have fewer people working, the one thought that occurred to me was that what that means is we don't need people to do the things that we're already doing. If a product already existed or if a service already existed, we don't need more people to do that. So if you want to find a place for yourself in the economy, if there's not one for you in the workforce right now, you have to think of something new, right?
You have to invent your own job, basically, or at least get in on the ground floor of a job that's just now being invented.
Exactly.
You know, yeah.
Or develop a product that hasn't been produced before and that isn't easily produced by a machine. Some value add on top of something that a machine can easily add. I think the problem with this is that it flies in the face of the set of expectations that we've had up to now. Up to now, for most of us, employment means finding a niche within an existing economy, that there's a lot of different needs that different kinds of work meet. So you develop a set of skills that makes you good for some particular set of work, and then you'll go meet those needs, and you'll be a productive member of society, you'll have a job, and you'll make money, and life is great. Now what we're saying is something different. It's like, no, you have to go create the need maybe too. You have to aim ahead of the market and figure out something that maybe no one even understands they need yet. The people who can make that happen, they're the ones who are going to actually continue to generate jobs. And the people who are able to do that for themselves are going to be the ones who are the most resilient in the economy that's coming. But it comes down to, I think, a lot more people. If the idea of employment is going to survive at all, I think a lot more people are going to be employed doing things that they thought up themselves, and that they do for briefer periods of time, because they'll have to think of something else, you know, a year down the road or 2 years down the road or maybe 5 or 10 years down the road.
I think what I want to do is invent a vending machine that gives injections of Draco.
That's a good idea.
And then just put these vending machines all over. Feeling low, you might need a little booster shot of that which kills all viruses. So, you know, anyway.
That's a great idea for a business, actually. and we've talked about how basically healthcare needs to be automated anyhow. So
I just wonder if FDA would have anything to say about my idea.
No, I don't. How's it any of their business? No, they wouldn't.
Exactly.
Let me just tell you, Stephen. Go ahead, and I'll take care of the FDA for you. Okay.
Hey, if you can handle that side of it, I'll handle the other side. Hey, our listeners are witnessing the birth of a great business here, right here and now on the show. So
that's right.
There you are.
We'll talk about this years from now when we're both in prison.
Exactly.
here's how I think this all ties together. Okay, this is because it feels like we're ending on a bleak note, but I really don't think we are at all. Because if the answer is that we have to constantly be learning and constantly be changing and developing, isn't it great that there's now things like MITx where we can go become certified in whole new fields of knowledge at any point in our lives that we need to at virtually no cost in order to support that kind of economy? I mean, it feels like we're not really ready for that. But on the other hand, when you start thinking about it, looking about it, maybe we are getting ready for that.
Can you imagine what this? You know, we have a world that the old model is just going to. I pity the in some ways the the smaller college institutions, because I just don't see how they survive this.
Right.
You know, how are they going? How is a small college going to survive when we need to retrain every 5 years? But we absolutely refuse to pay what the small college would require us to pay. Instead, we do MITx or Yale X or Harvard X or something like that, and we just do it every few years, because we have to get retrained to do something new, because that's how fast things are changing. In a world like that, does it matter so much if you're 60 years old and you've been retrained five times, or if you're 20 years old and you're just coming in the first time, you know, does it matter? It begins to matter less if you ever went to college, because what, you know, what I learned in college, you know, now, Phil, 20 years ago, that, you know, it was some, I learned some important things, but quite frankly, it really all it was a stepping stone to other things. And day in, day out, what I do for a living now, you know, has very little to do with what I learned back in college. You know, it's because I've had to retrain so many times. But so I just see
the little ones are going to have a hard time. Sally says it's going to that room, it's going to put them all out of business. Maybe, or maybe they'll adapt. Yeah. Maybe they'll change their business model and they'll find a way to be relevant. Those that become highly specialist, for example, might find a niche. But it will definitely, the landscape will look different. That's for sure.
It might be that they just become, meeting places for people that are, you know, want to network while doing MITx work. You know, I don't know.
They might be tutors to help you get through MITx faster. I mean,
exactly.
It may be like that.
It's different, a completely different kind of a business model than what, you know, what we've been seeing.
Anyway, you know what this conversation is bizarrely similar to, Stephen, is our final topic from last week when we were talking about bookstores becoming coffee shops. And
exactly.
It could be that, yeah, in fact, small colleges, state universities, whole state universities become like these really elaborate coffee shops, right, where people get together and, hang out while they're actually working on getting certified through some other online source. But if they're smart, those existing edifices, those existing institutions will find some way to be relevant within this certifying an online context. If they're smart, I think they'll figure out.
Here's my prediction. I'll go even farther than what you just said. I think the whole world's going to become a coffee shop. I think. I mean, think about it. Every place that so much of employment now is ad hoc. You know, we get together these groups to do these little projects, and then we disperse and get together and do other projects with other groups. I mean, what better environment to do that in than kind of an elaborate coffee shop? You know, I mean, it could be both the educational model of the future, the bookstore model of the future, the working model of the future. And shoot, I mean, when you can get on Amazon and buy everything that you could get down at the Walmart without having to, you know, deal with Walmart and have it sent straight to your house or your wherever. It begins to become, that's the retail model of the future too. Everything is a coffee.
They better have coffee.
Make a good coffee and I'm there, you know. So.
You have nailed it. The future, the whole world's going to be a coffee shop populated by sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers. I really think you've given us our picture of the world that's coming. You should do an article over in H Plus about that. I really think you should. I think you've identified what the world is turning into. Who would have guessed? I think it's right though. I hope there's muffins.
Yeah, exactly. Really good ones. And big. You know, we need big muffins though.
We're gonna need big muffins. All right. Well, Stephen, I think we need to jump quickly to our music.
I think so, and if I can find it, here it is. It is the Christmas Special 2011 by BBS Music.
BBS Music with the Christmas Special 2011. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thank you all for listening. Happy holidays to all of our listeners. We will be back again next week with our final show of 2011. Hope you'll be able to join us. And until next week, live to see it.